好，大家好，我是峰哥啊。接下来继续给大家读这篇，William James，美国心理学家，一个世纪前的心理学家，他当时所写的这个，其实是他的一套讲座了，叫做《The Varieties of Religious Experience: A Study in Human Nature》。我们的第一个 lecture 其实还没有讲完啊。好，那我们继续。Perhaps the commonest expression of this assumption that spiritual value is undone if lowly origin be asserted is seen in those comments, which unsentimental people so often pass on their more sentimental acquaintances. Alfred believes in immortality so strongly because his temperament is so emotional. Fanny's extraordinary conscientiousness is merely a matter of over-instigated nerves. William's melancholy about the universe is due to bad digestion. Perhaps, probably his liver is torpid. Eliza's delight in her church is a symptom of her historical constitution. Peter would be less troubled about his soul if he would take more exercise in the open air, etc. A more fully developed example of the same kind of reasoning is the fashion, quite common nowadays among certain writers, of criticizing the religious emotions by showing a connection between them and the sexual life. Conversion is a crisis of puberty and adolescence. The macerations of saints and the devotion of missionaries are only instances of the parental instinct of self-sacrifice gone astray. For the historical nun, starving for natural life, Christ is but an imaginary substitute for a more earthly object of affection, and the like. 那这里有个注解，就是 As with many ideas that float in the air of one's time, this notion shrinks from dogmatic general statement and expresses itself only partially and by innuendo. Wow, it seems to me that few conceptions are less instructive than this reinterpretation of religion as perverted sexuality. It reminds one so crudely, is it often employed, of the famous Catholic taunt that the Reformation may be best understood by remembering that its foes, ic origo, was Luther's wish to marry a nun. The effects are infinitely wider than the alleged causes, and for the most part, opposite in nature. It is true that in the vast collection of religious phenomena, some are undisguisedly amatory. Examples, sex deities, obscene rites, polytheism, and ecstatic feelings of union with the Savior in a few Christian mystics. But then why not equally call religion an aberration of the digestive function and prove one's point by the worship of Bacchus and Ceres, or by the ecstatic feelings of some other saints about the Eucharist? Religious language clothes itself in such poor symbols as our life affords, and the whole organism gives overtones of comment whenever the mind is strongly stirred to expression. Language drawn from eating and drinking is probably as common in religious literature as is language drawn from the sexual life. We hunger and thirst after righteousness. We find the Lord a sweet savor. We taste and see that he is good. Spiritual milk for American babes, drawn from the breasts of both testaments. It's a subtitle of the once famous New England primer, and Christian devotional literature indeed quite flows in milk, thought of from the point of view not of the mother, but of the greedy baby. Saint Francis de Sales, for instance, thus describes the orison of quietude. In this state, the soul is like a little child still at the breast, whose mother, to caress him, whilst he is still in her arms, makes her milk distill into his mouth without his even moving his lips. So it is here. Our Lord desires that our will should be satisfied with sucking the milk which His Majesty pours into our mouth, and that we should relish the sweetness without even knowing that it comes from the Lord. And again, Consider the little infants, united and joined to the breasts of their nursing mothers. You see that from time to time they press themselves closer by little starts, to which the pleasure of sucking prompts them. Even so, during this orison, the heart united to its God oftentimes makes attempts at closer union by movements during which it presses closer upon the divine sweetness. Chemin de la Perfection, Chapter 31, Amour de Dieu. In fact, one might almost as well interpret religion as a perversion of the respiratory function. The Bible is full of the language of respiratory oppression. Hide not thine ear at my breathing. My groaning is not hid from thee. My heart pants. My strength faileth me. My bones are hot with my roaring all the night long. As the heart pants after the water brooks, so my soul pants after thee, O my God. God's breath in man is the title of the chief work of our best-known American mystic, Thomas Lake Harris. And in certain non-Christian countries, the foundation of all religious disciplines consists in regulation of the inspiration and expiration. These arguments are as good as much of the reasoning one hears in favor of the secular theory. But the champions of the latter will then say that their chief argument has no analog elsewhere. The two main phenomena of religion, namely melancholy and conversion, they will say, are essentially phenomena of adolescence, and therefore synchronous with the development of sexual life, to which the retort again is easy. Even were the asserted synchrony unrestrictly true as a fact, which it is not, it is not only the sexual life, but the entire higher mental life which awakens during adolescence. One might then as well set up the thesis that the interest in mechanics, physics, chemistry, logic, philosophy, and sociology, which springs up during adolescent years, along with that in poetry and religion, is also a perversion of the sexual instinct. But that would be too absurd. Moreover, if the argument from synchrony is to decide, what is to be done with the fact that the religious age par excellence would seem to be old age, when the uproar of the sexual life is past? The plain truth is that to interpret religion, one must in the end look at the immediate content of the religious consciousness. The moment one does this, one sees how wholly disconnected it is in the main form, the content of the sexual consciousness. Everything about the two things differs: objects, moods, faculties concerned, and acts impelled to. Any general assimilation is simply impossible. What we find most often is complete hostility and contrast. If now the defenders of the sexual theory say that this makes no difference to their thesis, that without the chemical contributions which the sex organs make to the blood, the brain would not be nourished so as to carry on religious activities, this final proposition may be true or not true, but at any rate it has become profoundly uninstructive. We can deduce no consequences from it which help us to interpret religion's meaning or value. In this sense, the religious life depends just as much upon the spleen, the pancreas, and the kidneys as on the sexual apparatus. And the whole theory has lost its point in evaporating into a vague general assertion of the dependence, somehow, of the mind upon the body. We're surely all familiar in a general way with this method of discrediting states of mind for which we have an antipathy. We all use it to some degree in criticizing persons whose states of mind we regard as overstrained. But when other people criticize our own more exalted soul flights by calling them nothing but expressions of our organic disposition, we feel outraged and hurt. For we know that, whatever be our organism's peculiarities, our mental states have their substantive value and as revelations of the living truth, and we wish that all this medical materialism could be made to hold its tongue. Medical materialism seems indeed a good appellation for the two simple-minded system of thought which we're considering. Medical materialism finishes up St. Paul by calling his vision on the road to Damascus a discharging lesion of the occipital cortex, he being an epileptic. It snuffs out St. Teresa as a hysteric, St. Francis of Assisi as an hereditary degenerate, George Fox's discontent with the shams of his age as pinning for spiritual veracity, it treats as a symptom of a disordered colon. Carlyle's organ tones of misery, it accounts for by a gastro-duodenal catar. All such mental overtensions, it says, are, when you come to the bottom of the matter, mere affairs of diathesis. Auto-intoxications, most probably, due to the perverted action of various glands, which physiology will yet discover. And the medical materialism then thinks that the spiritual authority of all such personages is successfully undermined. For first-rate example of medical materialist reasoning, see an article on Le Variétés du Type de Vault by Dr. Binet Sanglais in the blah, 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 blah. Let us ourselves look at the matter in the largest possible way. Modern psychology, finding definite psychophysical connections to hold good, assumes as a convenient hypothesis that the dependence of mental states upon bodily conditions must be thoroughgoing and complete. If we adopt the assumption, then of course what medical materialism insists on must be true in a general way, if not in every detail. St. Paul certainly had once an epileptoid, if not an epileptic seizure. George Fox was an hereditary degenerate. Carlyle was undoubtedly auto-intoxicated by some organ or other, no matter which, and the rest. But now I ask you, how can such an existential account of facts of mental history decide in one way or another upon their spiritual significance? According to the general postulate of psychology just referred to, there is not a single one of our state of mind, high or low, healthy or morbid, that has not some organic process as its condition. Scientific theories are organically conditioned, just as much as religious emotions are, and if we only knew the facts intimately enough, we should doubtless see the liver determining the dicta of the sturdy atheist as decisively as it does those of the Methodist under conviction anxious about his soul. When it alters in one way the blood that percolates it, we get the Methodist. When in another way, we get the atheist from form of mind. So of all our raptures and our drynessness, our longings and pantings, our questions and beliefs that are equally organically founded, be they religious or of non-religious content, to plead the organic causation of a religious state of mind, then in refutation of its claim to possess superior spiritual value, is quite illogical and arbitrary, unless one has already worked out in advance some psychophysical theory connecting spiritual values in general with determinate sorts of physiological change. Otherwise, none of our thoughts and feelings, not even our scientific doctrines, not even our disbeliefs, could retain any value as revelation of the truth. For every one of them, without exception, flows from the state of its possessor's body at the time. It is needless to say that medical materialism draws in point or fact no such sweeping skeptical conclusion. It is sure, just as every simple man is sure, that some states of mind are inwardly superior to others and reveals to us more truth, and in this it simply makes use of an ordinary spiritual judgment. It has no physiological theory of the production of these its favorite states by which it may accredit them, and its attempt to discredit the state which it dislikes, by vaguely associating them with nerves and liver, and connecting them with names connoting bodily affliction, is altogether altogether illogical and inconsistent. Let us play fair in this whole matter, and be quite candid with ourselves and with the facts. When we think certain states of mind superior to others, is it ever because of what we know concerning their organic antecedents? No. It is always for two entirely different reasons. It is either because we take an immediate delight in them, or else it is because we believe them to bring us good consequential fruits for life. When we speak disparagingly of feverous fancies, surely the fever process as such is not the ground of disesteem. For aught we know to the contrary, 103 degrees or 104 degrees Fahrenheit might be a much more favorable temperature for truth to generate and sprout in, to germinate in and sprout in, than the more ordinary blood heat of 98 or 97 degrees. It is either the disagreeableness itself of the fancies, or their inability to bear the criticism of the convalescent hour, when we praise the thoughts which health brings, health's peculiar chemical metabolism have nothing to do with determining our judgment. We know, in fact, almost nothing about these metabolisms. It is the character of inner happiness in the thoughts which stamps them as good, or else their consistency with our other opinions and their serviceability for our need, which make them pass for true in our esteem.